Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb.
And this is Joe McCormick, and we've got something a little bit different for you today. Today on Weird House Cinema, we're going to be talking about The Viewing, directed by Panos Cosmatos, which is not a feature film, but an anthology episode in the 2022 Netflix series Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities. Rob, this was your pick. How did you end up bringing us into this zone?
Well, you know, I, certainly of modern directors, Panos is one of my favorite weird directors, and certainly someone who's always been in the back of my mind with Weird House Cinema. I think one of the reasons I dig this selection so much, though, is that it kind of fills a vital gap in modern genre cinema. I don't know if this will make sense or if this is just like me thinking too long and hard about it, but I feel like this movie, The Viewing, is in many ways like a B-movie creature feature, only without the B-movie budget limitations and with everything, you know, being somewhat subjected to a kind of like cinematic reduction, you know, and concentration of the flavors. As we've discussed on the show before, B-movies of today, at least to me, and I think to us to some degree, they lack the luster of those 20th century B-movies. And we've discussed some of the possible reasons why. You know, is it the technical proficiency or lack thereof sometimes in the modern B-movies? Is it digital film and digital effects versus practical and film? Or do these recent films just feel too contemporary?
I think a lot of modern B-movies are too self-conscious and not distinctive enough. They kind of lack some of the character of the B-movies of old and have a level of self-consciousness that takes some of the fun out. Like, I don't know. I mean, I've never gotten deep into the Sharknado series, but is like, I don't know how much of a drive I feel to watch Sharknado 5, but I do kind of want to watch Jaws 4 again.
You know? Yeah. You mentioned fun, and I think that's another key thing. Like a lot of B movies from the past, they're fun to watch. This selection, The Viewing, is, in at least to my taste, a very fun viewing experience. I every time I watch it, I laugh a little bit. I geek out over some of the visuals and the sounds, and I ponder over some of the strange choices that are made. And I think all of those things kind of match up with the sort of suite of experiences you tend to have with older B-movies. Though, obviously, to create this nowadays, you've got to spend a lot more money. You've got to throw in, you know, sort of a mixture of retro aesthetics, absurdism. In the case of Panos' film, certainly a heightened commitment to style. And I guess it's understandable why we don't see more films of this nature, because, yeah, it's clearly expensive to generate. And I guess at the end of the day, there's kind of like a who is this for question.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know. I feel like his most recent feature film, Mandy, was moderately successful, was it not? Or am I wrong about
that?
Oh,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, Mandy was successful, at least as far as my understanding of its metrics go. You know, it it had several different things that sort of propelled it and got people into theaters or certainly checking it out digitally later, be it, you know, the whole, you know, Cage Rage aspect of it. You wanted to see this really wonked out performance from Nicolas Cage, or certainly the face melting visuals and sounds of the picture. And also it had a very, I guess, dependable subgenre styling to it. It is a revenge film, yeah. Which is not my favorite genre of film, but it's something that you go into a movie like that, you kind of know what sort of ride you're in for, and that helps propel you through it.
Yeah, so maybe the revenge film or other genre trappings might explain part of the success there. But I feel like there is an audience for Panos Cosmatos.
Oh, and, absolutely. Yeah.
And for his style-driven approach. I mean, so I've seen now, I guess, all of the major film projects of Panos Cosmatos. So he's done two features, Beyond the Black Rainbow from 2010 and Mandy from 2018, and this Cabinet of Curiosities episode. I've seen all three now, and I don't know of anything else he's really released. One thing I think they all have in common is that they are primarily texture-driven rather than narrative-driven. So whereas you assume most filmmaking projects start with the story idea, they start with a script or a story concept, and then they come up with the audiovisual elements that are necessitated by that. They come up with sets and costumes and lighting schema and music and other visual and auditory motifs to serve and enrich the story. I think Panos's movies, I mean, I don't know about the process if it really works this way, but it feels like Panos's movies start with the texture. They start with maybe a vision of a room with sunken couches in a circle, with a strange sort of pipe organ chandelier hanging above them and a revolving table covered in lines of cocaine surrounded by like mirrored orange radiance, an AK-47 silhouetted in gold light. And then there's a specific soundtrack to this. He's hearing it in his head. There's like a chord progression playing in a dark saturated Moog synthesizer tone. Oh, and then, you know, for another movie, it's like I'm seeing a biker that's only in shadow, surrounded by pink light, covered head to toe in spikes like a pufferfish, but they're not spikes. They're made of rebar. Oh, and there's like a battle between two men wielding 10-foot long chainsaws and so forth and so forth. And it feels like they start with the images and the color palettes, the lighting, the music and all that. And they just kind of fill in a story or the suggestion of a story to link together all of that texture. I'd say of the three things, maybe Mandy is the most story-driven of his works, followed by this episode somewhere in the middle, and then Beyond the Black Rainbow seems the least story-driven and the most kind of texture-driven. But in all cases, it seems to me like the plot content is secondary to the sights and the sounds. And let me know in a minute if you disagree with that characterization, but I'll say at least as far as my perception of his style goes, it's interesting to me that this is not the only film we've covered that feels like it operates this way. But in other cases, we, for one thing, know it actually did operate that way in terms of how the film was made. And we know why. And it was because of ruthless concerns about budget and efficiency. So maybe Roger Corman says, oh, hot dog, we got some stock footage and some leftover sets and costumes from another movie. We got them on the cheap. Let's throw together a script that can use this footage of a rocket launching and these sparkly coats and this rented mansion in L.A. and et cetera, et cetera. Panos's movies do not feel like this at all. To the extent that it is actually guided by an ethic of texture first or production elements first rather than story first, it feels like a result of a lavish, indulgent passion for the project, completely opposite from the sort of mercenary or efficiency-focused attempt to wring every last drop of value out of your rentals and your commissions.
Yeah, there's a real commitment to vision with these pictures, and I love that it has thus far been sustained, because when Beyond the Black Rainbow came out, I loved it. It's just a film you can just breathe in. And then came Mandy, and then came this. And like each time, I'm afraid things are going to get less weird. Mm. That they're going to maybe become more concerned with these other aspects of cinematic storytelling. But thus far, no, it's been the weirdness, the visuals, and the sights and sounds, well beyond anything you've tested, that come first.
And to be clear, I don't know that this is how Panos operates. It's just that's how the product feels mm-hmm. in the end. I mean, it's entirely possible they do start with the script and then just something about the way, the way he realizes the sights and sounds of that story are so strong. They sort of take the pilot's chair in the actual viewing experience. But then this got me thinking about, well, what are the common themes in the narrative content, the stories of Panos Cosmatos' movies? And they seem to me to all represent a dual infatuation with, but also deep suspicion of, the many strands of the psychedelic and new age American counterculture of the 60s and 70s. So you've got murderous cults of Manson type hippies. You've got demonic bikers that deal drugs from hell. You have utopian alternative healing institutions that turn into psychotic prisons. Like the premise of Beyond the Black Rainbow is sort of like if an Esalen Institute workshop took hostages and turned them into psychic assassins. you've got hallucinogen use that is portrayed with a kind of glamorous horror. It's a double-edged sword. It's very alluring, but it also causes people to lose their minds and sometimes their souls. And the viewing in particular has a character who seems to me to be modeled on personalities associated with the Stanford Research Institute, which we've talked about on the show before, but basically a sort of research program famous for claiming to have found scientific evidence of paranormal powers like telekinesis and remote viewing, sometimes associated with other figures in the broader New Age movement. And this character in the viewing is explicitly portrayed as a charlatan. And in general, it seems like Panos's vision is one that's like obsessed with these sort of hippie and new age concepts, but also views mind expansion in all its forms as something that is beautiful and appealing, but often is a false promise that leads to suffering and chaos and destruction.
Yeah, I think that's very fair. I guess some of it is also probably rooted in exploitation cinema. Like certainly when you think of Beyond the Black Rainbow, I'm instantly reminded of Blue Sunshine, which yes. is very much a post hippies sort of aging out hippies exploitation film about that acid you took years ago, well, it turns out it'll make you into a bald psychopath now, so watch out and think twice about all the things you did 10 or 15 years ago.
We may have to do Blue Sunshine one day on Weird House. One of my favorite aspects of it is that if I remember right, doesn't all your hair fall off at once?
Yes,
it happens in an instant. It's like a wig that comes off. It's not gradual.
Yeah, it's an interesting film starring Zalman King.
Yeah, but I like that once it becomes clear in that movie that it's the acid that's turning people into to like kill zombies. Then you're trying to do a kind of detective thing of, wait, can we remember who took the acid at this party like 20 years ago?
Or yeah. Whatever? The big difference between Blue Sunshine and the works of Panos Cosmatos, though, I think, is that Blue Sunshine doesn't really, as I recall, doesn't really do much to give you like even a semi-glamorous idea of what the psychedelic experience could be like. Like not even like an exaggerated, dreamlike cinematic quality to it. Whereas Panos is going to dip into both wells, as you said. You know, there's going to be something alluring and otherworldly about it all, but also there's going to be this dark side.
Though, interestingly, at least to me, while the narrative content has this kind of tight obsession on like 60s and 70s hippie and new age themes, I feel like the texture that he's drawing from is time shifted a little bit later than that. Like there's overlap, mm-hmm. but it goes a little bit further into like the 80s, the kind of sights and sounds that he seems to be most sourcing from, sort of a late 70s and 80s club lighting and synthesizer bath, in a way, kind of a tech noir element.
Yeah, yeah. And you certainly know you're watching a Panos Cosmatos film, certainly thus far, based to a large degree on the colors and the light and this like searing sense of the lights. Like, you know, it's like the deadlights, you know, shining out of his pictures at you. I think some of these are called Panos flares. I think that's his, I think I picked that up somewhere. That's his name for some of these flares you see in his films.
I don't know specifically what that refers to, but there are very distinctive types of Panos shots. Like he loves a car racing through the dark in the night with the dials illuminated, glowing in the dark and like synthesizer music playing, or like a character in silhouette, just absolutely washed in colored light from behind. So you can't really see their features, but you just see the outline, and behind them, it is like an orange sun or a pink sun.
Yeah. And another big aspect, I would say, certainly in play in Beyond the Black Rainbow, and also in play in this film to a large extent, is a kind of, I would say, very like Quaaludian pacing at times. I think maybe that can maybe be a barrier to entry for some viewers who really want something that's going to really snap and move quickly. Like things are not necessarily going to move quickly in one of these films. There's going to be like a slow burning feeling. There's going to be maybe some time spent like watching a weird character actor like calmly emote for a while, which I love, but may not be everyone's cup of tea.
Oh, I totally agree. No, that's another distinctive Panos thing. His films, I would say, comprehensively lack momentum, both in terms of the overall plot and in terms of the moment-to-moment experience of the scenes. Like in the individual scenes, there's a lot of, so like when characters are talking to each other, there's a lot of kind of stopping and starting dialogue. A lot of dialogue scenes do not really kind of like build an intensity and have a exchange of power like, you know, your dialogue writing coach would say you're supposed to have. But they work in a totally different way. They're more just kind of painting a weird picture of interactions rather than escalating drama. That's not true of every scene, but that's very often true. And then I would say overall, yeah, there are the movies do build up towards something, but they don't have that kind of relentless snowballing feeling where it's like, oh, I've got to see what happens in the next scene. You have to kind of like submit to one of these films and say like, I'm just ready for it. And I think it's a very fun and rewarding experience. But it, yeah, they don't pull you with that like page turner thriller quality, whatever the movie equivalent of that is.
Yeah. This one, I have to say, when I saw it for the first time, I went in without, I think, even having seen a screenshot from it. I knew that it was Panos Cosmatos and that I was going to be on board for it, but not knowing anything about even what the plot was or what the viewing referred to, it did feel very like, unsafe, you know, like I just really didn't know what kind of story this was going to be. And it's not entirely clear for a large portion of the runtime what kind of story it's going to ultimately be. Yeah. It's not really until the last, say, 12 minutes of the, like, just less than an hour runtime that things really come to a head.
I mean, a lot of this thing is just characters doing drugs.
Yeah, it's true. So, yeah, that kind of brings me to my elevator pitch, is that this is essentially House on Haunted Hill, except instead of money and ghosts, it's drugs and face-melting encounters.
Now, Rob, is this one where you were saying that the trailer spoils the ending?
I wouldn't say the trailer spoils anything per se.
Oh, okay.
I kind of wanted for you something akin to my experience with it,
okay,
where you didn't know exactly what was going to happen.
Well, based on your recommendation, I did not watch the trailer. I just went in cold, and I'm glad I did. Yeah, I liked not knowing where it was going.
Yeah, so this is just going to be 25 seconds of trailer audio. So if you want to skip it, just skip ahead about 25 seconds. Let's have a listen.
Good evening. Tonight I'm going to gift you innate transcendence at the greatest expense.
Ah! Mesmerizing.
All right. Now, if you would like to experience the viewing before we proceed with the discussion here, well, as of this recording, the only way to experience it is as the seventh episode of Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities, as you mentioned earlier, on the streaming platform Netflix. But I really hope it does get a physical release at some point, either on its own or as part of this series, which, as we were just talking to JJ about, I think it's rather good. It's varied. It has a couple of other high points as far as my tastes go, and also I think there's a nice variety. Like some of the episodes are more thoughtful and character driven. A couple of them are certainly more tales from the crypt ish. In their basic structure, you know, here's a terrible person. He's become involved with some sort of supernatural element, and he's going to get his.
Mm-hmm. This is the only episode of this I've actually seen. So if I watch more, I may come back to it in October. It'd be a good seasonal viewing. I don't know if they're going to do another one.
I don't know that they've said one way or another. I think Del Toro has said that he's interested in heading it up, but I think I saw a quote where he was like, but if it doesn't happen, I'll also be a little bit relieved because it's a lot of work. So fingers crossed. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, let's talk about the people involved here. So we'll start at the top here with Panos Cosmatos, the director and one of the writers on this piece. Born 1974, Italian-Canadian film director and screenwriter. He's the son of director George P. Cosmatos, who lived 1941 through 2005, who himself gave us such weird films as 1983's Of Unknown Origin and 1989's Leviathan.
I didn't realize that connection until right before we came in to record, but that'll come up again in a minute.
Yeah. He also brought us some mainstream action films like Rambo, First Blood Part Two,
Beyond the Black Rambo,
yeah, Cobra from 1986, that's another Stallone, and Tombstone from 1993, the popular Western. Mm. Panos, by the way, who would have been I think 18 at the time, has a credit on that film, some sort of like assistant video operator in the second unit. So as we've been discussing, Panos' own writing and directing debut was 2010's Beyond the Black Rainbow, followed by the Nicolas Cage-helmed revenge horror movie Mandy, and then comes The Viewing, which I feel takes a slightly more absurdist approach and also dials down like the number of things he's trying to accomplish in the picture, while still going just all in and all out on its main set pieces.
Yeah, I would say, and this may just be in part due to its shorter runtime, but The Viewing takes us on fewer wild turns on the journey than his other two movies do. But the turns that are taken are just as wild.
Yeah. As for his next film, I believe it is set to be something titled Necrocosm. I don't know that we really know anything about what this is going to consist of, except that it's supposedly going to be more of a sci-fi film. So I'm excited to find out what it could possibly be. Now, his co-writer on this is Aaron Stewart Ahn. Not sure about the dates for this writer, but he was one of the co-writers of Mandy alongside Panos and one Casper Kelly. He was also a staff writer on the 2022 series The Witcher Blood Origin. And as a director, he directed a couple of Decemberist videos as well as a video for Death Cab for Cutie.
Hmm.
Now, getting into the cast here, yes, heading this up, playing the character Lionel Lassiter is Peter Weller, born 1947, American actor and director whose acting work goes all the way back into the early 70s, and he's still active today. He started out on Broadway, then did some TV, did a little bit of film, and then starred in George P. Cosmatos' 1983 psychological thriller Of Unknown Origin, a movie I have not seen, but I've heard good things about. It's a psychological horror film about a man who becomes obsessed with killing a rat that's infesting his home.
I don't know. That sounds like a premise of like a comedy. You know, this guy's like, oh, this rat's driving me crazy.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those plots that could go either way. But anyway, so that was 83's Of Unknown Origin. Then in 1984, he played the title role in The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, which, of course, has a deliriously weird cast and is a well-known weird cult film. In 1987, he became RoboCop, a role he would play again in 1990's RoboCop 2. Other films of note, at least to us, include the 1989 underwater horror sci-fi film Leviathan, which was also directed by George P. Cosmatos, Cronenberg's Naked Lunch in 91, Screamers in 95, that's based on a Philip K. Dick short story called Second Variety, and he's done more and more TV work in recent decades, including Sons of Anarchy, Star Trek Enterprise. He's done some Batman voiceover work, and as a TV director, he's been rather prolific there as well. Since the mid-90s, I believe, directed numerous episodes of such shows as Homicide, Life on the Street, Sons of Anarchy, and more.
You know, I first came to love Peter Weller as RoboCop and as Buckaroo Banzai, as well as in some relatively, kind of cold performances in B-movies. Like you mentioned the 89 underwater horror thriller Leviathan, where in that movie, one of the main things I remember is he wears a hat so stiff it should have still had the price tag stuck to it. Like, he's playing this like underwater drill rig manager, but it's this hat that's like the brim has never once been gripped by a human hand. But yeah, in a lot of these movies I'm familiar with, he's, you know, playing the handsome, cool as a cucumber leading man. But in his later career, Peter Weller has really aged into a totally different kind of performer, a sort of reptilian character actor who, if they were remaking the Super Mario Brothers movie today in the style of the one with Bob Hoskins, I think Peter Weller would be an excellent choice to play Dennis Hopper's King Koopa. This man, he so easily inhabits the role of a character who has experienced beyond pleasure and pain, beyond good and evil, and you could easily make high-quality Sawyer family furniture out of him.
Yeah, he's really fun in this as an immoral, vampire-esque, rich beyond conscious recluse, a would-be benefactor of artists and academics. It seems like a role he really gets to ease into and have a lot of fun with.
He plays a living mummy who encourages you to sin.
Yeah, but very convincing and charismatic. Yeah. And like we're talking about this beforehand, like how many actors today can use the word daddy-o in a picture and it still come off as cool and suave, you know?
Oh, yeah.
The comparison to Dennis Hopper, I think, is key. Like, this is a role it would have been a different Lionel Lassiter. It would have had a different energy to it, but Dennis Hopper could have played this role as well.
Yeah, that would have been a more high-strung Lionel Lassiter, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could see that.
All right. Lionel Lassiter has an attendant. He has a couple of attendants, but he has a doctor that attends to him by the name of Dr. Zara, played by Sophia Boutella, born 1982, French-Algerian actress, dancer, and model. If you're not sure who I'm talking about, if you saw a picture of her, you would recognize her. She's been in 2014's Kingsman, The Secret Service, 2016's Star Trek Beyond. I think she has a lot of makeup on in that one. She was in 2017's Atomic Blonde, and she was in 2017's The Mummy, in which she plays the mummy battling Tom Cruise. So she's the mummy in that mummy movie.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. So she's on the posters and all.
Does she defeat Tom Cruise in the end? I hope so.
Yeah, I think so. I think she defeats him, wraps him up, stores him away, and takes over the world. I never saw it, but that's my assumption because they didn't do anything else with that series, so it must have wrapped up. She's also going to star in Zack Snyder's upcoming sci-fi film Rebel Moon, and it looks like she's prominently featured on the posters for that.
Mm.
But in this, She comes off like a total vampire, a total seductress. In fact, when I first started watching this, I just assumed that both Dr. Zara and Lionel Lassiter must be vampires. That must be where this episode is going. Turns out that's not the case, but there's still a vampire quality to these characters.
Yeah, she has a clear fascination with power and evil that you can sort of almost feel in her mouth when she talks about it.
Mm. All right, we also have a character by the name of Randall Roth, played by Eric Andre, born 1983, American comedian, actor, and musician, probably best known, I guess, depending on your age and, you know, what your interests are, but probably best known for Adult Swim's The Eric Andre Show, or his role on the second season of HBO's The Righteous Gemstones.
Oh, yeah.
But he's popped up in a lot of things over the years, and also, of course, he has a stand-up career, he does music. I think that I'm probably like not generally the target audience for his comedy, so I wasn't sure going into this film for the first time exactly what sort of performance we'd be in for, but I ultimately thought he was great in this. He's able to lean into the more absurd and energetic aspects of the script, like when this character is like screaming or running, you know, he does a great job with that. But I also thought he brought a lot of believability to the character in the quieter moments.
Oh, yeah. Maybe I am more the target audience of his comedy. I don't know. I kept expecting him to reply to Lionel Lassiter saying, "I don't trust like that." It is always surprising to me to see Eric Andre in roles where he's actually playing a scripted character, I guess, because on The Eric Andre Show, his personality is like an extreme weather event. It's just totally uncontrollable and chaotic, and it seems hard to believe that he could actually just like say his lines and be in character, but of course he can, and he's quite good at it. I really, really enjoyed him in season two of The Righteous Gemstones, and I think he's great here too.
Yeah, a real treat. All right, the next actor of note here, playing the character Charlotte Ji is Charlene Yi, born 1986. American actor, comedian, musician, and writer. I believe they have improv and musical roots. Their first film role was 2007's Knocked Up from Judd Apatow. and they worked with him on some other projects as well. Their voice work includes such Cartoon Network shows as Steven Universe and We Bare Bears.
I think this character is interesting because it is a very modest and socially awkward scientist character who is surrounded mostly by hedonists and other various synesthetes.
Mm-hmm. As we'll get to it, there's a part where everyone gets their favorite drink, and Charlotte's favorite drink is just a ginger ale. But I assume a really good one, like one of those that comes in a nice bottle and, you know, doesn't have a lot of like crazy artificial sweeteners in it, where you can really taste the ginger.
I too appreciate a high quality ginger ale.
but this is a fun performance. Adorable, awkward, believable in many nice ways. Like, as we'll get into, the dialogue in this at times I think has an intentional clunkiness to it.
Yes.
And it's interesting to see which performers are able to breathe more life into those lines, and which and the ones that I'm not going to say can't, but don't perhaps due to artistic choices. Mm-hmm. So I tended to believe Charlotte as a character, which I think, you know, pays off in the end.
Oh, yeah.
All right. We also have Steve Agee playing Guy Landon, who is kind of a grumpy caricature of a popular novelist. I don't know who in particular this might be patterned after. It's not a Stephen King type character, but it's some sort of popular novelist who maybe is not putting out as successful of work as he did in previous years.
Well, I'm trying to think what novelist in the 70s would be showing up on a lot of late night talk shows. And is this supposed to be Norman Mailer or something? Maybe.
Maybe so. Now, Steve Agee is an actor that's going to be familiar to a number of you. Born 1969. Another noted comedic performer, best known to many for his recent work on some of the James Gunn DC shows and films. I haven't watched any of those, but I think he has a recurring character on those. I know him mostly from his role as Steve, one of the neighbors, I believe, on the Sarah Silverman program that ran 2007 through 2010. He's also done a lot of voice work as well, because has a very distinctive work. And like I say, is definitely a great comedic performer and can breathe a lot of life into a comedic role.
He plays a role that conspicuously swears a lot.
Yes. Yeah. Swears a lot. And I think ultimately has kind of like a B-cinema feel to it, because this is the character where the clunkier lines of dialogue feel intentionally clunky.
Yes.
But in a way that kind of works.
He talks kind of like he was written to sound like a detective in a hack 70s cop movie.
Yeah. It's definitely one of the performances in this film. Every time I watch it, I kind of think it over a lot, and I'm like, what is it about this performance that why does it feel this way, you know? And I kind of go back and forth on to what degree it works. And I think I'm landing currently in the area that it absolutely works, but it's supposed to have this kind of B cinema clunkiness to it. Mm-hmm. Now, we also have a character by the name of Targ Reinhard, played by Michael Theriault, Canadian actor with extensive Shakespearean theater credits. His TV credits include Hemlock Grove, Rain, and Chucky, the Child's Play TV series. He has a recurring role on that. Yeah, in this, he's a fraudulent psychic, was that what you would say?
Psychic, and I think just sort of like a New Age movement figure, it seems. So the character is named Targ Reinhardt, and I think this absolutely must be named after Russell Targ, the American parapsychologist and physicist who was famous for being one of the researchers affiliated with the Stanford Research Institute, trying to prove the validity of various paranormal phenomena, like remote viewing. And so this character seems to me to be a caricature of, first of all, like a combination of paranormal evangelists like Targ and Hal Puthoff and people, but also of their most famous subject, Uri Geller.
Oh, okay. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think there's mention of bending spoons with one's mind in this film. But this is a very pompous and ridiculous, over-the-top character that's clearly here mostly to just be mocked and for comedic effect, and is successful in that role.
he multiple times is caught talking about that which he knows not, like he's trying to opine on architecture, and then like he doesn't actually know anything about architecture.
Yeah. A lot of Guy Landon's lines are him just, you know, poking fun at or calling this character out on his BS. We also have a character named Hector, who we ultimately don't know much about. He has this great moment where it looks like he's going to tell us his story, but then he gets cut off and doesn't get to tell the story. But Hector is played by Saad Siddiqui, a Pakistan-born actor with TV and film credits going back to around 2007. He's popped up on such shows as Nikita, Orphan Black, Star Trek Discovery, The Handmaid's Tale, and DC's Legends of Tomorrow.
I like his vibe. Hector has a lot of scenes of just kind of standing there looking at the rest of the cast and kind of gently smiling or nodding.
Yeah.
It's a good vibe.
Yeah, he's, like, I think, low-key the best humorous character in the film. He's used very well.
Wait, is he the one driving the van when he tells everybody they have to stop talking and listen to the audio program?
Yeah, yes, I believe he is. All right, now, mild spoiler, there will be a creature suit in this film. And the actor in that creature suit is Kevin Kepi, a 6'5 character and creature actor whose credits include another installment of Cabinet of Curiosities and also the 2022 movie Smile, in which he plays a character credited as Nightmare Mom. Like I say, I always, if there's anybody that is in a creature suit in a picture, I always want to call them out, because I get the impression, I'm not sure what all went into making the creature we see later in the film work, but it looks like there is some good physical performance at the heart of it.
Wait, you said 6'5 character and creature actor. Did you mean this actor is 6'5", or you are rating this person 6 out of 5?
No, he's 6'5". So
okay.
He's like, based on the images I've seen of him, he's like a tall, slender man, which seems to work well for a lot of modern physical horror characters. Like back in the old day, in the gorilla suit days, what you really wanted was more of like a short, you know, thick individual who could really occupy that gorilla suit. And then the gorilla suit still has a place in modern monsters, I think. But it seems like, yeah, well, past few decades, some of the real standouts have been more of the tall, lanky sort. Finally, getting to the music on this one, which the music is always an important part of Panos Cosmatos' film. Beyond the Black Rainbow featured the work of Sonoya Caves, the solo project of Black Mountain synth player Jeremy Schmidt. Mandy featured one of the final scores of Johan Johansson. And this one is scored by experimental electronic artist Daniel Lopatin, born 1982. He also did the score for 2019's Uncut Gems, which that's the Adam Sandler film that I thought was depressing, but quite good, and had a great score.
It's a downer, and it's highly stressful, but it's a great movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Lopatin also did 2017's Good Time, 2015's Partisan, and 2013's The Bling Ring. I think that was a Sofia Coppola film. And his main solo project is Oneotrix Point Never, or OPN. I believe he's signed to Warp. I'm not familiar with his discography, but JJ is. JJ chimed in here and set us straight on how to pronounce this. Oneotrix Point Never. I'm going to have to check it out. I haven't really checked anything out beyond his work for this particular film. But it's, I feel like the score for the viewing, it has some nice range to it. At times there's kind of this an Andes tape loop kind of a thing going on, like some looped flutes playing. Other times it's like a driving 80s pop feel, or other times, of course, it's glittering synths and much more.
There's also just kind of an 80s bass club loop that plays a bit while they're hanging out on the couch.
Yeah, yeah. And it's varied in part because this music also makes up the custom soundtrack that Lionel Lasseter has commissioned for his house. So it's a lot of fun. Anyway, you can find a mashup of all of his music for The Viewing in the track The Viewing Suite, which was released on the Cabinet of Curiosities soundtrack. You can stream that wherever you get your music.
Did you ever get the sense that when Lionel Lasseter was bragging about the things he had people make for him, it was kind of like Panos was in the character bragging about the things he had people make for him for his movie, his house.
Yeah, I guess in a sense you could apply that to Panos, but also Guillermo del Toro. You know, Guillermo del Toro is well known for being sort of like the maestro at the center of the film, bringing on a lot of like very talented individuals to help craft. You know, not only the performance of the roles, but certainly like the all the artistry, bringing in well known illustrators and so forth to help bring something alive visually. So in a way, Lasseter is kind of like this darker vision of a Panos or a Guillermo. And in a way, though, that whereas Panos and Guillermo del Toro are both trying to create something for the world to consume, Lionel Lasseter is creating something entirely for his own enjoyment. At least, I mean, he also seems to want to, send people off in the world to do great things, but he also wants some things just for himself.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. All right, well, I guess this is the part of the episode where we would normally talk about the plot, but as we talked about earlier, number one, Panos films are not especially plot-driven, so I don't think this doesn't feel like one where it really makes sense to me to recap the plot in minute detail. Maybe instead I think we should like focus on the series of sets and set pieces that emerge in succession throughout the runtime and discuss how they're used.
Yeah, we don't have very many set pieces in this film, but the ones that we do have are pretty splendid, and we get to spend a lot of time in them.
Now, at the beginning, we get the characters before they go to Lasseter's mansion gathering in a parking garage. So all the main characters, the four main characters, have been summoned to Lasseter's house, House on Haunted Hill style, mm-hmm. with a formal invitation. They don't know each other and they don't know him, though it seems they, I think, all know about him. He seems to have a reputation for being rich and powerful, though people don't know how he made his fortune.
Yeah, there seems to be, they describe him as being someone that you used to see on TV, one assumes, all the time, and now he's become more reclusive and more mysterious. And yeah, suddenly there's an invitation to attend a viewing at his fabulous Sandpiper house, which you you get the impression is like the house itself is famous because it is, you know, no doubt been, you know, designed by some truly gifted architect, and you know, every aspect of it has been tailored to Lionel Lasseter's specific tastes.
What do you think about setting the meeting of these characters in this dark parking garage at night? Something about that just seems like such a powerful allusion to films of the 80s that seemed to me very obsessed with the parking garage as a threatening atmosphere.
Yeah. I mean, I guess some of that is post-Watergate, right? That parking garages are where, you know, shady or secretive dealings go on. The parking garage is also it's the underworld that we have created to allow our vehicular obsession to take over everything. And it's interesting. This is the main view we get of the outside world of this film, though we do get a wider view at the end of a city, of a cityscape. But the cityscape is also going to be very parking deck-esque, you know, like sort of just grimy, dismal concrete, kind of a world devoid of flavor.
Yeah. So we meet the characters they meet. I think it's when Charlotte, the astrophysicist, arrives and meets the other characters. They sort of introduce each other and they say, what do they all have in common? They don't know each other, but they say they've all been on late night talk shows. And I'm like, oh man, this just seems like so much in the Panos lane, this like 70s new age lane. You're imagining people who would show up on a 70s late night talk show to talk about how they've, you know, discovered psychic powers are real or something. I'm kind of imagining it's the show where they interview the TV set containing Professor Brian Oblivion in Videodrome.
So not even like a second or third guest on, say, Late Night with David Letterman back in the day, but like somebody you would see on some other strange talk show.
Yeah.
that is in the even later, that comes on after Letterman.
I don't even know if that's a real thing. I have an impression that it was, that there were like weirder, sort of more off-brand talk shows, mm-hmm. that would have the like really zany guests and everything back then. You got your mainstream, I don't know, Dick Cavett and stuff, and then you've got the stuff that comes on late at night. Is that even real? I don't know. But Panos has convinced me that's part of history.
I think it may have been the case, especially in markets like LA and New York. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, what is, in Ghostbusters 2, Peter Venkman runs a weird talk
right.
show, doesn't he? And mm-hmm. I feel like that must be sort of parodying something that existed.
Yeah. I'd be interested to hear from folks who grew up in those media markets that can speak to that. So anyway, these are characters who, they're used to getting the invitation and accepting, apparently without really too much thought into the matter. And they have accepted. They say, yeah, I'll go to the Sandpiper house and meet Lionel Lasseter. And so the van has come to pick them up.
Now, the van is being driven by the character Hector, and this is the part where they're initially talking as they load into the back of the van and drive along. But at some point, Hector tells them to stop talking, and they have to listen to it. I think he calls it the audio program, but it's like Lasseter has some music that they are specifically assigned to listen to on the ride to the house, more synth music. And I don't know, I like that.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering if at one point they were going to have like some Peter Weller voiceover there, and that was going to be the audio program. Mm-hmm. And then they just decided that the synth music worked better. But yeah, at any rate, I like it.
No, this is the music he wants them to listen to, and I think it's somewhere around here that we also first get our glimpse of Peter Weller's character, Lionel Lasseter himself. where we see him in an environment just flooded with orange light, with his head almost looking kind of triangular, surrounded by wispy gray or white hair. And he looks like an absolute lizard, kind of a vampire, kind of a mummy. Mm-hmm. Or also, I thought of a very specific movie analog, which is he looks like the witch in the Stan Winston movie Pumpkinhead.
I think that's a strong possibility because, Panos loves his weird colored lights, but he also includes many homages to different films. And, this seems kind of like one of those sort of rub the fur films, certainly from the decades of interest to this filmmaker.
Mm-hmm. And I think we've talked about on the show before that Pumpkinhead kind of has some shortcomings in terms of storytelling, but has some great visual flair. There are a lot of scenes with really excellent horror atmosphere and lighting, and a good tall, spindly creature that I think you could compare somewhat to this one later on.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point.
But anyway, so they're taken to the mansion, to the Sandpiper house, and they are summoned to this living room with a circle of sunken couches in the middle of the floor. And I think this room, again, just get the feeling that the vision of this room was a major reason this episode was made. So I think we should describe it in great detail. So it's, like I said, in the middle of the room, there is a table, and it is surrounded by sunken couches with sort of leather, what do you call that? Kind of stuffed leather backing. Mm-hmm. And then in the middle of the room, there is a chandelier of sorts that looks like an inverted conical mound of organ pipes, or maybe like a columnar basalt, hanging from the ceiling. So the ceiling slopes inward toward it, and then it forms a kind of, oh, almost like a nozzle or a nipple in the middle of the ceiling, of these pillars. All around on the floor, there is this decorative motif that's like these big U-shaped bins, like giant horseshoe magnets with long bars coming out. It seems kind of an Art Deco suggestive design. And then the room is awash in gold and orange light. And then on the walls, there are these backlit circular panels that have guns mounted in them. So there's like an AK-47 that you only see in shadow because it's got gold light blasting from behind it.
Yes. And yet there's a hint of Aztec architecture to the whole thing, isn't there?
Yeah, so that's what the character Targ says. He's like musing about how it's Aztec inspired or something, and is repeatedly called out for not knowing what he's talking about.
Yeah, this whole space is just splendid. Like when you first roll into it, and as you roll into this this kind of point of view shot, it feels like this is a space you're exploring in the film Baraka. You know, it feels otherworldly and kind of sacred. It also feels like maybe it should be on Arrakis. You know, it's just such a strange and lovely set.
Now, when they first arrive, I think it's interesting that Lassiter's people start a succession of treats, which are like, it starts with a drink of choice for each person, but progresses into alcohol and drugs. That there, it's like it's almost like a tasting course of different sort of enticements for the mouth, most beverage based and then drug based. So the first thing that they see when they get there is they're asked to sit next to your favorite drink. So for Targ, it is a beer that he dubs Superb. And I was thinking, is beer really Targ's drink? I don't know. But then the funniest one for me is Landon sits down, he tastes something, he's like, wow, it's the perfect screwdriver.
Yeah, this is so strange. Because a screwdriver, if memory serves, a screwdriver is just vodka and orange juice, right?
Yes, that's what it is. I don't want to insult, if people enjoy a screwdriver or whatever, but I think of it, that's a utility drink. That's something I think of like, I don't know, college students drinking. It's not usually the kind of thing where people would be like, oh, it's amazing, a superb screwdriver.
Yeah, it's, and I guess that's why it's so funny, because I don't even think the proportions are necessary for the screwdriver. Like, on a lark here, I went to Imbibe Magazine's website, and I was like, okay, I'm going to put in screwdriver and see if it comes up. Because sometimes they'll still have some very simple classic drink cocktail recipes listed there, but nothing comes up for screwdriver. They're just like, get out of here, looking for a screwdriver on this website.
And so there's that. But then also what the other characters get is interesting. Charlotte gets just a ginger ale. I think we mentioned that earlier. It says it's a great ginger ale. And then Roth, Eric Andre's character, gets some Lapsang Souchong tea. Now, I don't know anything about that, but Rob, do you have an opinion on what's the perfect Lapsang Souchong?
This is not a tea I have any knowledge of, so I can't.
But, is it real? But
I don't know. There are so many teas, and I am only familiar with the very slim selection of them. I do like the detail where he says it's just the right amount of honey as sweetener. So their host, Lionel Lassiter here, seems to have just a supernatural knowledge of what their exact desires are.
I just looked it up. It is real. Lapsang Souchong is a black tea made with Camellia sinensis leaves that is smoke dried over a pine wood fire, cold smoked.
Well, that sounds quite good. But yeah, Targ's beer. He's like, it's a perfect beer. It's so cold.
Okay. Well, anyway, but like I said, there's sort of a tasting course menu. You know, there is a series of temptations. So after this, Lassiter comes out and he tells the story of this amazing whiskey from Japan that has survived bombings and earthquakes. And then they pour it for all of them. And there's a detail about the table that you can just see is one of these like textural details that was imagined early on, that the outer rim of the table rotates around. So like, as Dr. Zara pours these drinks, they just sort of like get rolled around the table to their recipient.
I've also read that the glasses they drink this whiskey from are supposedly the same glasses that we see in Blade Runner.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah, supposedly. I have not fact checked it, but it sounds appropriate. It sounds like the sort of detail that would be present in this film.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, as the characters talk in these scenes, I thought that there was something different about the viewing compared to the two Panos Cosmatos movies I've seen, which is that in this one, there seemed to be a kind of conscious attempt at anti-realism in some of the acting and dialogue and characterization. Like, this was not true of the two movies, but characters here sometimes speak like they are deliberately avoiding verisimilitude, if you know what I mean, Rob. There's a kind of, like, I found it enjoyable, but a kind of awkward stiltedness and unnatural quality to the rhythm of some of the conversations that plays into the comedy. And this is not something I would say about either of Panos's movies, in which, again, in those movies sometimes have an unreal quality, but it's more dreamlike, whereas this is more a kind of intentional B-movie awkwardness. It seems like a unique choice here. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I think that seems to be part of the intention here, that an intentional B-movie awkwardness to at least some of the performances. And I think it might also, you could also look at it from another direction too, and look at, like, this is ultimately a film about, like, people and their desires and the things that they are grasping for, questing after in life. And two of the characters, really the two that often feel the clunkiest, are also the ones that are the most full of it. Targ and Landon, you know, they're Landon is just there to sort of, like, puff up his chest and take things out on Targ. Targ is there to sound brilliant and insightful, certainly, you know, despite the fact that his whole identity is tied up in just a lie and just nonsense. And so those are the characters, that stand out the most with this clunky quality.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting to see, like, how the characters behave in the scene. Like, so as they're given, you know, the drinks and the drugs and stuff, so it progresses from this onto them smoking things and snorting things. And Guy Landon's just, like, on board. He just wants it all. And it's interesting. Targ sort of tries to resist, but then gives in to it. Charlotte seems to not naturally have a very indulgent personality, but is also just curious in this situation. Whereas Roth is an interesting character because this is the Eric Andre character. He is trying to resist the life of, like, he's trying to quit smoking. He's trying to resist the life of drugs and alcohol and all that he is so accustomed to.
Yeah. He knows that there's a line, and if he crosses that line, he's not going to be able to control his consumption. But he has enough self-control to sort of stay away from that line, or try to, for most of the runtime here.
But also, it's funny that throughout this, there's this kind of puffery, people building themselves up, like Lassiter and Landon and these people trying to impress everyone else. Lassiter, at one point, he starts quoting proverbs to encourage everybody else to indulge. Like, he says, every person has two lives, the person they were before and the person they were after they realize they only have one. I don't know if that's a real proverb.
But it sounds convincing coming from Lassiter. You're like, yeah, I guess I should have space cocaine. Because, of course, we learned that Dr. Zara has this, this kind of shady background, is involved in essentially, like, mad blood science. And this this space cocaine that she's providing everyone with has like some, it's like high grade and has some sort of like blue additive to it that is going to make everyone's experience perfect. Because ultimately, as we learn, Lassiter is here to, yes, to pump everybody full of illicit substances, but also to encourage them and to get everybody synced up for a singular experience, the titular viewing of a particular object.
And what is that viewing? Well, he gets them into the chamber to look at the obelisk. Now, I think there are a few rules of the chamber with the obelisk.
Or one rule.
Yeah.
And that is there's no smoking in the obelisk chamber. We do learn this the hard way. But other than that, I think it's just whatever goes. You're allowed to touch the obelisk, apparently, and you're encouraged to look at it and to discuss your ideas concerning what it might be.
Well, I like how, did I remember this correctly, that really there is no information on what the obelisk is or where it comes from? Is that right?
Yeah, Lassiter tells us that he obtained it like at the ultimate cost and at great expense and so forth, that, you know, but that's it. That's it. And when they ask him, like, what is it? He's like, I have no idea. So it's a complete anomaly. There's no discussion of, oh, well, this fell from the sky, or this was discovered, you know, on the bottom of the ocean or in the deepest caverns of the earth. No, here it is. I have obtained it. Take a look at it. You tell me what you think it is.
Yeah, there is zero information about it except here it is, I have it, and now you're looking at it.
Tests that they've run have been inconclusive. X-rays tell them nothing. But for some reason, they do have this idea that you should not smoke around it.
That's just common sense. I mean, so what is it? It's like a large black object with many different surfaces and indentations and projections. In a way, it looks almost like a bit of xenomorph biology.
Yeah, there's kind of a Giger-esque quality to it. But also, it does look like some sort of strange rock. It looks like a space rock, and it's kind of described as such. And I think that's the, if you had to guess, you might think, well, this fell from the sky, clearly. This is some sort of space object. And they start talking about it, and they have, everyone's reaction to it is a little different. You know, Guy Landon is like, this is a rock. I'm done. I don't want to look at this thing. Where, and I think most of the other characters, though, begin to see that there is something special about this. There is something that is sort of calling out to them from it.
And then, well, everything goes off the rails when Eric Andre blows some cannabis smoke into it.
Yes. Yeah. It kind of inhales the smoke. And then, things get really crazy really quickly. This is like the last 12 minutes of the picture here. It starts, there's a psychic effect. And he's like, yeah, Eric Andre's character is like, I think I broke your rock, dude. And it starts crumbling, cracking open. And a strange substance is in the middle. Some sort of orange gelatinous form. And at this point, it reminds one a lot of The Blob, especially the early scenes in both the original Blob and the remake, where this hard, rocky substance cracks open and a blob creature emerges, only instead of it being kind of like red in color, this one is bright orange.
It is a giant orange wax clam that then, from which project a couple of the main features of it, these things that are like horns, but sometimes don't appear to be rigid, like they morph between being flexible arms, like the arms of an octopus, and then being like the rigid corkscrew horns of a mountain goat.
Yeah, or like the horns of a ram or something. The monster in its varied forms, it definitely spoke to me in terms of The Blob, the Ark of the Covenant, the horns of Golgotharoth, tentacles, slug antenna, and some other elements as well. And the whole time, though, and a lot of this is also due to, you know, the sound design, the lighting, everything else, but the creature design too, it feels completely otherworldly without seeming too much like anything else I've seen in other films. As we've discussed before, with modern monster movies, there can be kind of a sameness, kind of a built by committee quality to it. And this creature or whatever it is feels wholly different. And yeah, there's just a strong like WTF feel for this entire encounter.
Oh, but there's also so much melting to happen here. It's a melt to remember.
Yeah, so they're scanning. Everybody gets scanned. Everyone in the room is scanned. And then some people start melting. One person's head explodes. And really, ultimately, everyone is going to either melt, explode, be absorbed by orange slime, or run screaming for their lives.
Yeah, and obviously we're deep into spoiler territory here, but in the end, it is Lassiter who is absorbed by the creature. So the creature like sort of slithers, it like wounds him psychically and he collapses on the floor. And this is after it has melted Landon and Targ and Dr. Zara, I think.
Mm-hmm, and yeah, she melts.
Yeah, they all get melted by it or they explode. And then it goes up to Lassiter and it takes him within the mass of the wax. And then he sort of, I guess, becomes the scaffold or the skeleton for this creature to become vaguely humanoid.
Yeah, becomes this. And this is where we get the creature suit, because we have a tall bipedal creature with kind of a zombified face. And the two tentacles remain, but on the shoulders, continuing to quest around as if continuing to sense and take in data.
And then Charlotte and Roth, they both escape. They make it out, though Roth stops to try to do more drugs on the way out. Yeah. but they make it out. Hector comes in. He gets the gold AK-47 and tries to shoot the monster, but he is like zapped electrically and explodes.
Yep. The creature clearly has just vast reservoirs of power.
So we see our two survivors like get into an 80s or 70s sports car and then drive away with such acceleration that Eric Andre's like face is rippling like in a wind tunnel. And then they make it out. But then we see the creature with, I guess, Lassiter inside it. I don't know if Lassiter is thought to in some way still be alive and a part of this creature, or if it's just sort of like used him like the thing does, maybe as a format, as like a template. Mm-hmm. But now it walks out of the mansion, and then we see it like walk into a sewer and then emerge out the other end of the sewer line, walking into a big like aqueduct, a big, what do you call it? Like the canals in LA, big concrete canal, drainage canal. And it just walks out into there and is now among the people.
Yeah. This kind of, again, this kind of like concrete, dismal version of LA. And immediately we begin to see lights start to go out in the city as if like it's immense energy and it's a like electrical disturbance is already knocking out power. Like just by like, it's hard to figure out what the creature thinks or wants to get out of this. Like clearly it's going to destroy the world. There's no question about that. The question is, does it want to destroy the world, or is it just there to record the world, to sense the world, and in doing so will inevitably destroy everything?
Is there a reason for the differential fates of the characters? Like, why do Landon, Zara, Lassiter, and Reinhardt melt or get absorbed or whatever? And why do Roth and Z escape? Is it based on something about them individually? Does it mean something? Do those two, in a sense, refuse to look at the Ark like Indy and Marion? I couldn't really tell if there was anything like that, but I wonder if somebody out there has an interpretation of that sort.
Yeah, I'd love to hear what folks think about this. The best I could come up with, and I also have to realize that there may be no reason to it. It may just have to do with like likability of characters and or coolness of characters. Like obviously Lassiter has to become the monster, that sort of thing. But I was also thinking it might ultimately have to come down to desire and grasping. So the creature is an explorer. It's questing with its feelers. And so my read is that Landon, Reinhardt, and Zara, they're found wanting. There's something inauthentic about their relationship with the world and their desires in the world. Roth and Charlotte, they desire too much, or perhaps their desires are very specific and therefore they're able to get away. But Lassiter, he's in the Goldilocks zone for some reason, perhaps because he has just overarching general interest in everything. So he's the perfect fit for something that has come to like experience slash record slash destroy the entire world.
Perfect. It is canon now.
But yeah, that's the viewing. And the lovely thing about the viewing, the whole picture is like going into the obelisk chamber. There's no smoking, and it's about like, what do you take out of it? What's your interpretation of what transpires? An interpretation is not entirely necessary, but because it's ultimately a wild, weird ride that I enjoyed quite a bit. But yeah, it also raises questions, and you might well wonder, well, what comes next? And I like a nice open-ended, strange, like weird ending like this, where our main likable characters have escaped, but it doesn't seem like escape is in store for the world itself.
Right. There's no smoking in the obelisk chamber, which is now the entire universe.
Maybe in the sequel, he's just the creature's going out to find more dope smoke. That's the whole plot. I'd be down for that ride.
All right. That's all I got on the viewing.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and close it out here, but we'll remind you that Weird House Cinema occurs every Friday in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed, and you are invited to join us each week for that. We're primarily a science podcast with core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays, a short-form artifact or monster fact on Wednesdays, and on Mondays we do a listener mail episode. So write in. We'll read your listener mail, and we may read them on the program. If you want to check out all the movies we've covered on Weird House Cinema in the past, well, you can go to letterboxd.com. That's letterboxd.com. We have a profile there, Weird House, and you'll find a list of all the films we've covered. And you can do like neat things there, like divide them up by decade, divide them up by genre, and so forth. It's a lot of fun.
Huge thanks to our excellent audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.